what you fear for a golden girl.
One of the great pieces of music from the James Bond series and film over the years, that, of course, the title track from Goldfinger. Joining us tonight is Lee Pfeiffer, who is the co-author of The Incredible World of 007, an authorized celebration of James Bond. His name is Lee Pfeiffer. Lee, good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight, my friend.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
Let me go back here to the beginning and the release back in 1962 of that explosive picture, Dr. No, starring Sean Connery in the role of 007 James Bond. Was Sean Connery the first choice back then?
No, he was not. Actually, the producers had tried to consider Cary Grant, who was a friend of Cubby Broccoli, the producer, the co-producer of the Bond films. Mm-hmm. But Grant, when asked about it, basically said he liked the script, but he felt he just didn't want to get tied down with a series like that. Besides, as Sean Connery pointed out later on, that the budget for Dr. No, which was only $1 million at the time, couldn't have paid for Cary Grant's airfare. Curiously, Ian Fleming always anticipated that Hoagie Carmichael would have been the ideal James Bond, if you can believe that.
I can't believe that. You've got to be kidding. I can't see James Bond, you know, walking into a bar and going over to a piano, sitting down and playing "Sometimes I Wonder Why I Spend Each Lonely Night." You know, it just wouldn't fit for me.
Well, one of
I want to go back to what you said here. That the budget for the Dr. No picture was $1 million for the whole movie?
Yes, and they had to fight tooth and nail to get that financing. In fact, after the film was made, the studio had no idea what to do with it. They had never seen anything like it. It was far too humorous to be considered a straight action adventure, and it was far too violent to be considered a comedy. And they basically just dumped the film at some Midwestern drive-ins and considered it a disaster. But when word got back that it was playing to packed houses in Europe, they quickly withdrew it and gave it a red carpet release, and of course the rest is history. But Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, his partner at the time, couldn't find a single studio in Hollywood to touch the Bond properties. The most that they were given for a budget, I believe Columbia offered them $400,000 to do the first Bond film, which of course they turned down. They eventually went to United Artists, and Arthur Krim, who was running the studio at the time, gave them $1 million on a handshake. And he believed in the film, and of course the studio has profited very handsomely from that decision.
You know, it's curious to me that they couldn't have seen this success coming, considering the popularity of the James Bond novels in book form by Ian Fleming. These sold rather well over the years, as I recall.
Well, they had been, yes, they had done well in print. But again, if you go back at that time, Tom, things were so much more conservative. A lot of what made Fleming's books the bestsellers that they were is that they were quite titillating at the time and quite
right.
Sexual. A lot of studios at the time were quite squeamish about trying to translate that onto theater screens. And if you look at Dr. No, today it seems tame, but at the time it was a very controversial film. It was condemned by the Vatican, in fact.
You know, thinking back on James Bond films, the thing that I remember most about the early days, and I don't know if Dr. No had this particular bit of graphology in its opening, but you know the opening where you see the girl that I can best describe as having large breasts and long hair doing somersaults. You know what I'm saying?
In the eye of the beholder. Well, that was the genius of Maurice Binder, the late Maurice Binder, who was interviewed in our book, which is his last interview, in fact. Mr. Binder was an absolute genius when it came to main title designs. Up until Binder started working, most of the main titles found in films were quite uncreative. Binder originated the gun barrel that opened up every James Bond film and still does.
Right.
And also pioneered that use of nude models seen in silhouette doing those gymnastics that opened each Bond film.
Very, very well done, by the way. They really caught your attention and they really set you up for what was to follow.
And they caused controversy. Those titles are still causing controversy. Binder complained right up until he died a year or so ago that ABC was still very squeamish about showing those main titles and used to try to edit them in certain ways so that even the slightest hint of nudity would be removed, and Binder would always squawk about that.
You got to be kidding me. I mean, do the ABC people look at their afternoon soap operas and what goes
well,
on there? I mean,
he said these things have been shown on cable TV. They've been shown to children in theaters. I mean, who is going to get upset by it? But ABC, in fact, did a hatchet job on those films throughout the almost 20 years that they telecast them.
The commercial cutaway and the editing was terrible.
They
butchered continuity, they butchered storyline, they ruined the picture.
Well, they did. In fact, From Russia with Love probably suffered the most. They cut out literally 20 to 30 minutes each time that the film was shown, including the train fight sequence, which is considered by film students to be one of the finest examples of directing and editing of an action sequence ever put to film.
Mm-hmm.
It was all but eliminated during the TV show. Actually, Turner's doing a better job with it, so I'll give him some credit on that. He's showing them fairly much intact.
Let me ask you about the Sean Connery era in the production of James Bond pictures. How many did he make, Sean Connery?
Sean Connery made six of the Bond films for United Artists. He also made a comeback film in 1983 called Never Say Never Again. That was done outside of Albert Broccoli's Eon Productions empire. It was sort of a maverick Bond film, but it did find its audience, and it also did rather well at the box office.
How did Bond change as played by Sean Connery over the six pictures that he made in the original run?
Well, I think if you look at Bond in the very beginning, Connery was a little bit stilted in the role. He clearly felt uncomfortable having been a poor Scotsman who was cast in this role as a snobby Englishman. And I think some of that uncertainty can be seen in the first film, Dr. No. He was rather ruthless in the early films. I guess beginning with Goldfinger, he became much more of a humorous, a lot more humor started to creep into his performance.
Mm-hmm.
As the films went along, Connery became increasingly disgruntled, and I think that boredom is reflected in some of his later performances. He just became... He always complained that the character had just basically become a manipulator of gadgets, and to a certain degree that was the case.
Yeah, but that's part of the charm of James Bond, was that not only was he the manipulator, but he knew exactly what gadget to bring out at exactly what time to save the day.
Well, of course, no one can argue that with the producers for not taking the gadgets out, because if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
But I do admit, I agree with Connery in that... some of the suspense has been lost over the years. It has been regained in the Timothy Dalton films. But for a while, there was an amusement in seeing Bond getting out of certain situations, but there really wasn't any suspense. He would always just conveniently produce a gadget, press a button, and he would be out of this situation.
That's nothing new in cliffhanger-type situations or scenes in films. I mean, Batman for years, and the old serials did that.
Oh, absolutely.
And Michael Keaton did that very effectively in Batman 1.
Absolutely. You're certainly right. The gadgets, I doubt they'll ever make a film again without gadgets. They did try once on Her Majesty's Secret Service. Ironically, probably one of the best films of the series, but ran into some production problems, and there was almost a total lack of gadgets in the film. I think it worked better because of that, but the purists, and so did some of the purists, but the mass audience seemed to miss those gadgets from Pugh Branch, and they were brought back, and I guess they're here to stay.
Do you have a favorite James Bond film starring Sean Connery?
Well, I think Goldfinger is probably the high watermark of the series. I don't think they've ever made any terrible James Bond movies, and I think that's a mark of the genius of the producers of these films. I mean, some I like more than others. But none of them, would you say, couldn't be recommended as entertainment. But I think Goldfinger, everything just gelled right.
Great show.
I think you have to go back in time to understand how shocking and innovative and eye-popping that film was. At the time, I remember seeing it as an 8-year-old kid. I didn't even know what a laser beam was. And here's this man, he's threatened with castration and dissection with this spectacular-looking beam of light. And of course, today we have them in our TV sets. But at the time, that was an outrageous film. And I think it holds up very, very well today, as most of them do. Styles may change, some of the wardrobes and what have you, but none of these films appear to be outdated if you watch them today.
Which is the one where he is in the underwater sequence? Is that Thunderball?
That's Thunderball.
I love that picture. I love the scene where he's at the one end of the table that, you know, they're in the, he's with the monster, that you know, the bad guy, whatever his name is.
Largo.
Yeah, and they're at the long table in the undersea palace, right? And the guy, he's got the gun under the table, and it's firing.
Oh, you're thinking The Spy Who Loved Me. That was the other one. That was
Roger Moore. Yeah, all right, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Right, that was also a good film. A lot of people think that's Roger's best effort as James Bond, and I think I would have to agree with that. That's a marvelously entertaining
film. Wait a second, hold it. Was Roger Moore in that one?
Yes, he was.
You see, I could have sworn it was Sean Connery.
Well, I'm just wondering,
hear me out on this, how many people, as time passes, tend to really almost meld the two, Roger Moore and James Bond, and just remember scenes but not remember who played James Bond?
Well, it's true, and, you know, my wife Janet's been living with my James Bond fanaticism for years, and she'll always say, is this the one with the guy with the steel derby or the one with the guy with the mouth of the steel? To a lot of people, they're indistinguishable, but I say this to those people. You may not be able to distinguish a lot of them, but I believe if you sit down to watch them, they're almost impossible to turn off.
No question. We are talking tonight with Lee Pfeiffer, who's the co-author of The Incredible World of 007. In fact, I'll start taking your calls here on the toll-free exchange and try to get your own reactions to your favorite James Bond pictures. Trivia questions, we're at 800-756-0852. That is 800-756-0852. We'll be right back after these messages from the local stations. We are back with the co-author of The Incredible World of 007. His name is Lee Pfeiffer. We'll get to your phone calls here momentarily at 800-756-0852. How was the transition made from Sean Connery to Roger Moore? You know, if that had been a television show, the James Bond show, it never could have been done the way it was. But how was it handled so that the audiences really wouldn't be put off by the fact that a new guy was playing their favorite double agent?
Well, I think you have to remember that in between Connery and Moore was George Lazenby, who starred as Bond in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. He was not an actor. He was a model who kind of talked his way into obtaining the role of Bond. Did a very fine job in retrospect, but he had some problems dealing with the success and the fame that was about to engulf him, and he quit the role during production of the film. He finished the film, of course, but announced that he wasn't going to do any more. It turned out to be a bad career move, although George is a very rich man today in spite of that. But that that convinced the producers, because Lazenby tried to emulate Connery, that the way to go was just to not to pretend that there was any sort of a Connery essence to the person taking over the role. With Roger Moore, they got somebody who already had a built-in audience identification. They made no awkward script changes saying that he had plastic surgery or something like that.
Right.
And Moore just appeared and made the role his own. Now, some people prefer Connery, some people prefer Moore. But in fairness to Roger, he did a very good job of embellishing the role with his own distinct personality, for better or worse.
By the way, in Goldfinger in 1964, you mentioned that that was your favorite, and it's a terrific picture. How did they ever get away with the name Pussy Galore for the heroine, the Bond
woman? Well, that caused a big problem.
Even today I can see that causing a bit of a stir.
Yeah, it's still a rather shocking name today. You probably couldn't use it even on a TV series.
If Carson were still doing The Tonight Show, it'd be a great Karnak answer, and I'm not going to say the question, okay?
You're right, Tom. At the time, it did cause a problem. They wanted to rename. It was suggested they rename.
I could see Ed McMahon saying, "Describe heaven on earth," and then Karnak would give that answer, you know. But
you are correct, sir.
Great one.
They suggested, someone suggested, they rename the character Kitty Galore. Of course, Broccoli and Saltzman. I mean, all you do with names are
that is so stupid.
But Broccoli and Saltzman were very influential at this time, by this time. They insisted on keeping Pussy Galore is the name, especially when in England there was a newspaper article with Prince Philip visiting the set, and it said, "Pussy meets the Prince."
Oh, man. Let me pause here for the radio stations. Back with your questions about 007. Carly Simon, nobody does it better. A song sung to me hundreds of times in my youth. We're talking tonight. Yeah, right. Lee Pfeiffer's on the line, the incredible world of 007. And here is Mr. Jan in Tupelo, Mississippi. Hi, Jan, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to have you on, Jan. How you been? Okay?
Been fine, sir. Good to be back on the UIV network.
Thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, sir.
I wanted to ask your author his opinion about Timothy Dalton. When I saw Timothy Dalton in The Living Daylights, I was so surprised because he took the Bond character totally away from the cartoon version that Roger Moore had done, and he took him back to the books. He made him dangerous, made him much more realistic. What's his assessment?
Well, I agree with you totally. Although I'm not among those that put down Roger Moore, I think Roger did a very good job with the character. His films were enormously successful, and the audience really liked him. But let's just say that he had an entirely different interpretation of the role. It did get increasingly cartoonish, I will agree with you there. Dalton has gone back to the basics. He's an absolutely brilliant actor. I think his performance in the last Bond film, License to Kill, is excellent work. And I think, and I hope if these legal matters get straightened out that have delayed the next James Bond movie, I would certainly hope that Dalton resumes the role. I think the future of Bond is in very good hands as long as Dalton is playing it.
Do you feel that the producers are happy with Dalton?
Yes, I know. In fact, I had lunch with Cubby Broccoli a couple of weeks ago.
And by the way, why do they call him Cubby Broccoli?
I have no idea. No, it's funny. after all this time, I've never asked him that. But I can tell you that the vegetable is indeed named after, I believe it's his great-uncle.
Yes, that's right.
Who popularized the vegetable in the United States.
But his real name is Albert R. Broccoli.
Albert R. Broccoli.
I mean, what, did he just walk in one day to a meeting and say, by the way, guys, call me Cubby?
Probably they'd call him anything he wants to be called.
Yeah, right.
Powerful man. But no, I have no idea. And it's funny, I've just gotten so used to calling him that I never... I believe my co-author, Phil Lisa, wanted to ask him that one time. But
I mean, doesn't it feel weird to call another guy Cubby? You know?
Yeah, I suppose, but I didn't have my arm around him at the time, Tom.
Anyway, Jan, I interrupted your question. Continue, please.
No, sir, I was just going to ask, you hear rumors every now and then that the producers are, good Lord, even considering Mel Gibson for the role. And I wondered if there was any truth to that, or if it is more that the trouble that MGM has been in has been the real reason why we haven't had a new Bond in a couple of years.
The reason why you haven't had a Bond in the last few years, and I have to be careful because I don't want to step on any toes,
right,
is Broccoli and his production company, Eon Productions, are involved in a lawsuit against the MGM studio. It does not stem from any actions on the part of the people who are running the studio today, but rather Mr. Peretti, who had run the studio a while back. It's a complicated lawsuit involving the sale of television rights. And hopefully it can get settled. I'm hopeful anyway that maybe it can get settled so the studio and Mr. Broccoli can go on to make another Bond film. Both sides very much want to make another Bond film. So
Good. Everyone's
hopeful one way or the other. Sometime next year they can start on one. I understand there is a script ready.
Good. That's terrific.
And I didn't know that it's Cubby's intention, at least what he told me, to use Dalton.
I think that's terrific. Dalton's the best Bond since Connery, I think.
Jan, I'm glad you called tonight. Thank you, Tom. All right, bye-bye. Here's Howard in Los Angeles. Hello.
Hello, fellow Bond fans.
Hello, how are you?
Kaylee, how are you?
Good.
Listen, before I want to talk about Roger Moore, but first I want to say a couple of things. You know, when you watch the Bond movies, it's like taking a trip around the world, you know. I mean, the locations are just out of this world, you know. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
No question.
No money putting those epics on the screen.
And by the way, you were playing Nobody Does It Better, Tom. You know, in 1978 at the Oscars, Aretha Franklin sang that song because it was nominated, and she just killed it. She did
massacre it.
I don't know why.
Any resemblance is purely coincidental.
Well, I'll tell you something, Howard and Lee. In the closed-circuit queue line down to Los Angeles, I was singing it along with Carly Simon, and if you think that she murdered it, man, I really, really took it off. Wow. Anyway, Howard, that's not why you called.
Well, yeah. Well, there's a million things I could talk about. But anyway, you know, Sean Connery is James Bond to me, and he will always be James Bond. But, you know, in my opinion, Roger Moore has always gotten the bad rap. In 1972, when the producers, you know, were looking for James Bond, you know, there were many good-looking guys. But to me, no one but Roger Moore could have played Bond at that time. He was well-known. He had charisma. The women loved him, and he was a damn good actor, in my opinion, very underrated. And you know, no one except him could have played Bond, and I think he saved the series.
Well, he did. He actually did, and we've tried to do a lot of justice to Roger Moore in our book. He was kind enough to cooperate. He's one of the interviews that we have in the book. Roger, I can't sing his praises enough. He's a very nice man. He's also a very underrated actor, I agree with you, not only in the Bond films, but also in some of the other films that he's done.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. Without Roger Moore, I'm not certain the series would have survived all these years.
And, you know, I talked to Patrick McNee a few weeks ago, who was, of course, in A View to a Kill, and,
right,
of course, is famous for The Avengers. And he told me that Roger wrote all the dialogue between him and Roger. Did
so
you know
he's
that?
A very talented man, and I think,
yeah,
a lot of what he did was ad-libbed. And I'm a big fan of Roger Moore's, and I would agree with everything that you've said.
And, Tom, by the way, the Bond movies won two Oscars. 1964, Goldfinger won for sound effects, and
right,
Thunderball won for special effects.
And they were
glad
nominated for several others.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And
glad
by the
you
way,
called. Yeah.
Dalton, I'm afraid to say, most women I know do not like Dalton. They love Roger, Sean, but they just don't like Dalton.
You haven't spoken to my wife, apparently.
Well, Dalton is a damn good actor, no doubt about that. But
how many pictures has Dalton made as James Bond?
Two.
He's made.
Well, I think that if he were to make, and the problem is he hasn't made one since 1989. But if he were to make one, say next year and the year after, and develop a following, I think he could be as successful
as the first. Well, he's not only could be a success. Contrary to what people think, Dalton's last film, License to Kill, was a huge smash on the international market. It didn't do all that well in the U.S. because it opened against Batman and Indiana Jones and Lethal Weapon, a few other films. But that film was a tremendous smash in the international market. I believe it did over $150 million. So on the international market, Dalton certainly has found his niche.
Okay, we'll continue with more of you. We're talking tonight with Lee Pfeiffer. Now, here is another Academy Award-nominated song, but how did this picture do for Your Eyes Only, Lee?
Well, actually, it did very well at the box office. At that time, Roger Moore had been toying with quitting the role. Originally, he said he wouldn't do it again. Broccoli started to test other actors. Eventually, they came to a meeting of the minds, but they really had to hurry up into production. For Your Eyes Only had the shortest production lead time of any Bond film to date. But it's basically noted as the film that brought Bond back to Earth after Moonraker, which was an extravagant, slapsticky type of film.
Remember the joke?
I think it's one of the best that Moore's ever done.
Remember the joke that Bette Midler told at the Academy Awards when she introduced whoever sang the song for Your Eyes Only? She said, "And now from the motion picture for Your Eyes Only." And the producers weren't kidding. But I guess it did pretty well.
It did. And all of the Bond films actually have done well. For Your Eyes Only was a big hit, just as most of the other ones that Roger did.
One of my producers, Paula Schuster in Los Angeles, is an enormous James Bond fan. And she asked a question that a lot of people may be wondering about, and that is Pierce Brosnan, who was tied to a television series and couldn't get out, yet was considered in the role of, I believe, was offered the role of James Bond.
Depending
would he
on
ever
who
be?
You listen to, according to Brosnan, I believe he's gone on record as saying he was actually offered it.
No. What does Cubby say?
Cubby has said now. This is years ago. I believe his official version was that Brosnan was a very strong contender for it, but I think he maintains he never actually formally offered it to him. I believe Brosnan and his people maintain that it was offered to him. What the actual situation was, I have no idea, but the important thing is that he didn't get it. And I think, for better or worse, the films are much different now than they would have been if Pierce had taken over the role. I think he would have continued in Roger Moore's vein, and obviously that would have pleased many people, and it would have displeased others.
Let me ask you something here. In an age of Terminator 2, in an age of high-tech pictures, will James Bond ever be as big as he was in the 1960s and 1970s?
Well, I think it's tough to say. I mean, it's certainly a very hot film property today. I think that we're just not as... we've seen too much nowadays, Tom. I don't think we're really going to see a film that's going to shock us the way those early Bond films do. But I can tell you there's an enormous James Bond fan club movement going throughout the world. Any number of clubs. If you look through the book, we've illustrated all the toys and memorabilia that have come out over the years. These things, people pay hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for some of these toys. It's a very thriving market for James Bond, and I would say that if they never did make another one, which I hope isn't the case, the legend will continue for many years to come. There's fan conventions going on in England, and I believe there's one in Chicago in October that's related to James Bond. So there's a very thriving fan movement out there. And as long as that is active, James Bond's here to stay.
What is the 007 electric drawing set?
Well, I'm not ashamed to say I have one of those in my attic. Actually, my wife always told me, either do something practical with all this junk or get rid of it. So we ended up writing the book, Phil and I. Phil, my co-author, has probably the biggest Bond collection in the world. And yes, the electric drawing set is a tracing set that I had when I was about 9 years old, and today it commands about $150. So,
Very good.
All of these toys are worth a fortune.
You.
Here's Butch in Lynchburg, Virginia. Hello.
The name's Bond. James Bond. No, just kidding. I was asking, or I've got a book that has a picture from Russia with Love, and apparently it's a behind-the-scenes picture of Ian Fleming wearing dark pants and a white sweater, sitting on a seat cane in front of the Orient Express. I noticed a couple of weeks ago when it was on PBS, they showed a scene when Connery and his Turkish companion was on the train. Apparently the train was supposed to have stopped at a railway crossing and the Turkish companion's son was supposed to meet him. Well, the train just kept going down the track and they show the son watching the train as it leaves. Well, as the train goes off in the distance, to the right-hand side, there is a man standing there with a cane wearing the exact same clothes as Ian Fleming, and it's only there for a few seconds.
But you can't distinguish his face. That's one of life's great mysteries. Is that or is that not Ian Fleming? The guy seems to be in the middle of a field doing nothing. I've heard arguments. There's no logical reason for him being there. Somebody said, well, did Ian just blunder in front of a camera, or is it a joke, or is it in fact Ian Fleming at all? I must remember, so many people have asked me that since the book came out. Phil and I will run that past Cubby Broccoli and ask him. I tend to believe it was not Fleming, because certainly there would have been some photographic record of his appearance in the film.
Right.
And I think if he was going to appear in it, he would have done something with some merit, at least have his face visible. Otherwise, what's the point?
Maybe he was camera shy.
Could be, but I know this scene that you're referring to. Many fans have brought it to our attention, but I can't. I've watched it 100 times. I can't distinguish the face.
Awesome.
All right, Butch, I'm glad you called. Thank you. Back with more of your calls and comments as time permits. The Incredible World of 007 continues on. Okay, we're back. Debbie, Charleston, South Carolina. Hello.
Hi.
Very quickly, Debbie, time's almost gone.
Okay. I'm a really big fan of the James Bond movies, but I'd like to know, what is the significance of the cats in the movies, especially the Persian cats?
Well, that was the pet of Blofeld, the arch-nemesis of Bond. He was in charge of the evil organization Spectre. That was not a Fleming touch. That was basically created by the filmmakers, but it worked very effectively. And, of course, at that time, you didn't see Blofeld's face, although he was later revealed in the other films.
Also, Debbie, it was an attempt at giving visualization to Kitty Galore. Thanks for calling tonight, Debbie.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Anyway, before we leave here, Lee, do you have any inside information? Well, we've already been through it. There are legalities involved, so we really don't know when the next Bond picture will go before the cameras.
Well, we're hopeful that it'll be next year. Let's hope that the lawsuit is settled. I get letters from people all over the world asking if I know anything. I don't, other than what I read in the press.
Well, listen, Lee, find it out, will you, kid?
We will.
All right, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Great hour. Thank you. Mr. Lee Phillips, co-author of The Incredible World of 007, an authorized celebration of James Bond. I'm T.S. This is the Tuesday Night Radio Show. On many of these same stations, we're coming right back.